Okay, today's April 4th. I'm just going to spend a few minutes before our Genesis class giving evidence to the fact that World War II was Mohammed's Bogu Mago. And I start by the point that Gogu Mago are not words that appear in Tanakh. Why the rabbis refer to this like war that initiates the coming of Mashiach as Gogu Mago fits into what I want to say here. Okay, in the Tanakh, Gog is the name of a king of a kingdom called Magog. He is Gog, the king of Magog, which is a nation that's mentioned in the beginning of Bereishis, who had a brother named Ashkenaz. Magog and Ashkenaz are the same thing. Okay? Now, there's a drash from Shimshon Ofer Hirsch that sees a lot of this Gog, Gog, Magog, that Gog Magog is like a system that wants to envelop the whole world. It wants to gain dominion as if though it covers the entire world, the Yoho. This is now drash, no doubt. Shimshon Ofer Hirsch says this, which is why, however, that we read about the war of Gog Magog on Chol Hamoed Sukkot, because Sukkot represents for us a holiday where we're ready to put this little thatched roof, this sukkah, this chach on top of us. That's all we need for protection. As long as God is looking after us, that's going to do it for us. The Haftorah of the first day of Sukkot, this is Chol Hamoed Sukkot. The Haftorah for the first day of Sukkot, right? Anybody know from which sefer? It's Zechariah, who speaks about a terrible war at the end of days. He speaks of it as if though it's some kind of a nuclear bomb. He says, people will melt as they stand, and their eyes will just disappear in their sockets. Right? The melt, remember that last scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark where they were looking at the Ark? Right? So that's how he describes this war. And then he says the only way that the Jews will survive this war is if they sit in the sukkah. And even Goyim, who choose to sit in the sukkah, will also survive. Now, of course, these are all metaphors. Not if I have to sit in the sukkah when bombs are falling in the sky. You should be in a bomb shelter. Okay? The sukkah, however, represents this drash, this is what Shimshon Ofer Hirsch says it, of what roofs are we building above our heads, and how do we feel we're enveloping ourselves in this world in realms of safety from the threats that are coming from about. The best thing is put yourself comfortably in the sukkah of God, ufros aleinu sukkas shalomecha, and you will survive to the end. Okay. Adkan, the connection of Gog Magog to Sukkot. Now let's get back to what's happening here. The Yechezkel, who refers to this war of Gog, the king of Magog, right, says that the battle is over Yerushalayim. Battle is over the Jewish, Yisrael and Yerushalayim, but it's the Jewish position vis-a-vis their time Yechezkel is writing this, there is no Yerushalayim, there is no Israel, we're in Galus, right? We're in exile from Nebuchadnezzar. And this battle will be about the rehabilitation of these places, Yisrael and Yerushalayim, that have been conquered. Now, I'm going to skip away from Yechezkel, which I've been doing until now, to a different book, equally cryptic, Daniel. Right? Daniel was prophesying at the time of the, also in between the first base of Mikdash and the second, enlivening the people and giving them the faith and the hope to return and rebuild Israel and Yerushalayim. Now, Daniel gives, in chapter 9 and chapter 12 of his book, gives very cryptic descriptions of how long to wait for these things to take place. A certain amount of weeks, a certain amount of yovels, a certain amount of years, a certain amount of... It's very cryptic. The secret of explaining these words, the Gemara at the beginning of Megillah says, is to know the time of Mashiach. Remember the Gemara says Unculus wrote Targum to Torah, Yonas and Menuziah wrote the Targum to Nevi'im, but there is no Targum to Kesuvim, because if there was, we'd know when Mashiach is coming, and Rashi says these chapters are Nevi'im. Okay? Right? At the very last few psukim of Daniel, he says to wait 1,290 years and 1,335 years. Now you're not going to know when to start, when to end this time period. You don't want to know when it starts. So Daniel says, still cryptic, but he says that if you wait these amount of years from the time that the Mizbach Hashem was in a state of Shikutz Shomeim. And the Mizbeach is Shomeim, means the Mizbeach of God is no longer working. Now, when do you start counting these 1290 and 1335 years? From the time that the Mizbeach was Shomeim. So the Malbim says there were five times in our history where the Mizbeach was Shomeim. The last one was Churban Bayis Sheni. The fourth one was Antiochus, right before the Hanukkah rebellion. The third was Churban Bayis Rishon. You should know this about Tanakh. There were two times in Tanakh where the Mizbeach was no longer being used. During the time of Ataliah, for 6 years, and during the time of Achaz, for something like the same amount of time. Ataliah, Achaz, Bayis Rishon, Chanukah, before the Chanukah story where they were offering pigs, and Bayis Sheni. So the Malbims figures that if you count 1290 at 1335 years from any one of these, the one that's Shikutz Shomeim, then you will get the year Mashiach comes. Right? He says it's not this, because while it was Shomeim, it wasn't Shikutz. It's not this, because while it was Shikutz, it wasn't Shomeim. But Mizbeach was working, just with offering pigs on it. Right? Shikutz means disgusting and bereft and non-existent. Churban Bayis Rishon was Shomeim, but not Shikutz. Only two left. Ataliah, it was Shomeim, but not Shikutz. It just says she stopped. Achaz, now look at Achaz in Divrei Hayyamim. It says he went to the Arameans, took plans of their temple, and cleared out the Beis HaMikdash, and reconstituted our Beis HaMikdash to be like the Aramean temple, and stopped the sacrificial order. And he says that if that's Shikutz and Shomeim, and he counted 1290 and 1335 years from when Achaz started doing this in Divrei Hayyamim, and he came to this year. He's writing this in the 1860s. And he predicted that Ashkenaz, he said, which is Germany, will be involved in, and now he says why it's called Gog and Magog. You figure out there are 1, 2, 3, 4 threes, which is 12. 2 sixes, which is also 12. A Gog and Magog. 3 sixes, which is 18. And a Mem, which is 40. This is why he says that the rabbis refer to the war as Gog Milchemet, Gog and Magog. Because the gematria of Gog and Magog is 70. It's going to be a world war. 70 is the Umos HaOlam. It doesn't have to mean that every single nations fighting in this war. But every single nation on planet Earth will have an interest in who should win the war. You could be neutral, right? Because you don't want to take sides. But deep down, the people of your country, well, we're interested in how this war goes. Okay? So, it's going to be a world war, said the Malbim, fought in 1915, involving Ashkenaz. Problem is that World War I did not involve Yisrael or Yerushalayim. Jews were not an Indian in World War I. Jews fought for both sides. But they were in World War II. If you do feel historically that World War II was pretty much guaranteed to be fought by a feckless world against a rising Germany, right? Even as late as 1937, France and England could easily have overrun Germany. France alone had still had more soldiers in 1937. But wasn't to be. So, this is the plus. I think I mentioned this in a different context. I don't know if in this class. But Zechariah, right before referring to this sukkah thing, that you'll be saved from it if you sit in the sukkah, speaks regarding 2/3 of the Jews who will perish in a certain area. He calls them Pi Shnayim, chapter 13 of Zechariah, and the remaining Shlish will help build back the land until and that could be a reference to the 9 million Jews in Europe before World War II and 3 million survived. This is all conjecture, of course. The reason why he said it was Rabbi Rofe who sent this, the reason why he's quoting me, this was a class I probably gave him, maybe it was in Daniel or in Peskel. The reason why I would rather say this is because if it is in our prophecy that 2/3 of Jews should die at a certain time, part of a certain tragedy, I'd rather that's in our past. Right? Isn't it in our best interest to say that this has happened already? Right? Okay. I usually shy away from doing things like this because Christians are good at this too. They write this, all the numbers on the board and all the prophecies and go, that's Jesus. They do it with the end of Daniel.
What's the purpose of it? Like, you think we should pay attention to more? Like, is this helpful?
I would just say, Yechezkel chapter 37 and 38 are prophecies in our history. I believe the prophecies in Tanakh. Some of the portion explain the kind of Gog and Magog is a figurative or an ideological.
But how much insight do we really, if the interpretation is subjective, and we can't verify whether that's right, then why is it relevant? I mean, isn't it more dangerous to attach interpretation to a prophecy? Meaning, because we only know the prophecy is true, we don't know whether interpretation is true, so we could be wrong.
There's some of them we do a better job than others at explaining. Right after he talks about the 2/3 perishing, he says, and then God will shortly afterwards stamp his foot in the middle of Jerusalem and divide the city into two. The Jews on one side will be okay, Jews on the other side will suffer. Shortly afterwards, he'll pick up his foot and reunite the city. Now, what can I say? That's of Jerusalem in 1967 to 1949 to 1967, when the Jordanians took over and kicked all the Jews out, and then it was reunited. Some things you can do a better job than others. I just have the Bible in front of me, and I'll say, okay, I should avoid reading it altogether, but Zechariah especially is given to this kind of work. He's very apocalyptic. His first prophecy is in his 13 visions. The first vision is, and the last are of three horses chasing a fourth. And Rabbanel, points out that Zechariah often doesn't know what he expresses. God, I can't tell what I see. How am I supposed to interpret it? I can't even describe what I see. So an angel tells him what he sees, right? And so Barbanel says that the first vision is Alexander the Great giving up his kingdom to three different rulers, right? In Europe, Middle East, and Africa. And the last vision is Columbus sailing to the New World with three ships. It's really quite brilliant, his thesis, and how that last one initiates what hopefully will be our, he's writing this in the 1490s, will hopefully be our ultimate salvation, and it may be true. The New World presented us certainly with better opportunities than we had had for the previous 1500 years, and we did somewhat pave the way for some terrible tragedies, but also where we stand today. And we take nothing for granted, but that's what we do with Tanakh. I tend to avoid doing those kind of things, but I'm just telling you which portion are doing it. And I just did this because someone mentioned, I was quoted in another class that we're in today, so I said, and no one was here at the time, so I started doing this, and I said, okay, when people come, I'll go, but let's just take this question, and we have to go back to the class.
Are we able to suggest that a prophecy could come to fruition twice? Like it already happened in our past?
Rashi says that a lot, especially in Yechezkel, books like Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, where it stands to reason that if Yechezkel is speaking about temple, kind of, a return kind of prophecy, he's talking about it right in his own time. Right? And yet, we do interpret certain prophecies to refer to things that haven't happened yet. When Yirmiyahu, for instance, speaks about vineyards that will once again be planted in the north of Israel, and Israel will produce much wheat and grain and fruit, that prophecy had not taken place from the time Yirmiyahu spoke it until the last 100 years. Right? But it's flourishing now. So, okay, we want to say that there are you get it? That there are particular. Christians are good at this too. I have to tell you, they spend a lot of time on these kind of things. Right? Okay. I once gave a course on Christian polemics, and of course we went through all those things all throughout the Tanakh. Okay. All right, I just want to make sure that everybody remembers what we did in last class was to show that Amos, the Haftorah of Parshas Vayeshev, that Amos was his trick, if you will, was to convince the people to think of a story they knew was wrong and bad. Who here thinks that the sale of Yosef was a good part of our history? Right? So, you hear the story of a rich man taking the sheep that belongs to a poor man, and then he took the one sheep that man loved so much, right? He refused to take many of his own, bless you. So you got the guy to say, oh yeah, that man should be, that's a dead man who did that. And then you say, Atah Ish. So Amos would do the same with the people. You hear all these things, Beged Chavulim, and things that remind you of Mechiras Yosef, and then he'd say, don't you realize that we're doing all these things today? Right? It's really quite brilliant. All right, that was chapter 2 of Amos that connected to Parshas Vayeshev. And let's now move into the continuation of the rehabilitation. Okay, let's take this to Bereishis Perek Mem Beis. Everybody have it? Bereishis Mem. Vayar Yaakov ki yeshever b'mitzrayim. Everybody turn there, please. Bereishis Mem Beis. You must have a text in front of you. Vayar Yaakov ki yeshever b'mitzrayim. Of course, Vayar here means he understood. He didn't actually see the thing. Lishbor Bor, Shever is that big building in Israel, in Jerusalem called the Mashbir.
right? Rosh Mashbir, Kabir. Right? So Shever, it means the that there's food there. I heard that there's someone distributing food there. Doesn't know who it is, of course. It's Yosef, right? So Vayar Yaakov ki yesh Shever b'Mitzrayim. Vayomer Yaakov levanav lama tisra'u. Okay. Right. So Rashi first tells us Mehechan Ra. What did he see? Valalo Ra Ela Shama Shnemar Hine Shamati. That the Shever, right? Umau Vayar Ra'a Ba'aspaklaria Shel Kodesh Sha'adayin Yeshlo Sever B'Mitzrayim. What makes Rashi do this? To say Pshat. So I think that the main thing is not just it's the word Vayar, definitely. The Targum Onkelos is V'chaza, like Chazon Yeshayahu, which seems to mean like a type of prophecy. Where Yaakov himself might have didn't quite get it. He says, "There's something I heard about a wise man in Egypt handing out food. Let's go. They're okay. We don't have to starve." V'lohi son of Vua Mamash Lahodio Beferush Sheze Yosef. I think what's bothering Rashi here is a very unusual word. It's only mentioned a few times in the whole Torah. Shever. It's an unusual word. Okay? Bor means food. Right? Lishbor bor. Right? So maybe the share is like a share bar? I don't know. But it's an unusual word. So the Hebrew word sever, like Inecho Lelecho Yisaberu, Halohen Tisaberna, Naomi tells Rus and Orpah. So Yesh Shever, Rashi makes a drash. Yesh Sever, this hope. Right? It seems to me that the Vayar and the Shever, otherwise, why is a Pashtan writing something like this? So far from the Pshat. Yaakov just heard, he read in the paper, there's food in Egypt. It's expensive, but there's food.
The hope was about 5 minutes.
Yeah, that's what Rashi writes. So here's what I'm going to show you. What we're going to do is a series of Rashis right now. The beginning of Membet. It's a very, very interesting concept. A series of Rashis. I don't think even any one of them is the Pshat. Not one of them. But, taken in its totality, the first few Pesukim of Rashi reveals an underlying theme that I think the theme is Pshat. I want to give you an example of this before I go any further. But first I want to read Lama Tisra'u. Lama Tisra'u. Did anybody have an English translation there? What do you... Why are you looking at each other? Yes. Membeis. Bracious membeis. Do you have an English word?
It's very easy. How do you make yourself conspicuous?
Wow. That's good. I like it. That's good. Lamatis ra'u. Okay, some of Farshim just explained. What are you guys looking at each other? Go do something. It's food. Right? Okay.
Wait,
so, why do you make yourself
conspicuous?
No,
It's what Rashi says.
Yeah, let me tell
you. Why are you seen here? You shouldn't be here. You should be down in Egypt getting us food.
Like everybody else in town. In other words,
and what was your excuse?
This is Rashi. The excuse is we have plenty of food. We just don't want to put an ayin hara on our family that we don't have to go down to Egypt for food like everybody else. Now, Rashi writes that, and it's not pshat. That's the way you call it. That's the stone. They write their introduction. We will explain difficult words according to the Parish of Rashi. So why are you conspicuously looking at each other? You're making yourself conspicuous. That's what Rashi writes. Okay, Lama Tiru Atzmechem Bifnei Yishmael Ubnei Yos Esav. Ki'ilu atem sve'im ba'osa sha'a adayin hayolahem t'vua. Wow. Why do you make yourself look satisfied when your cousins, B'nai Esav and B'nai Yishmael, are all starving and going down to Egypt. You should go down too. I do have food. Yeah, but you're putting an ayin hara on us. Okay? Now, in parentheses, these are not really Rashi's words. These are the words of someone trying to explain Rashi. Nirali pshuto lama tisra'u lama yehu hakol mistaklin b'chem. Okay. In other words, that's exactly that English translation. Why are you making yourselves look so different than everybody else around here? You should go down like everybody else. Right? I don't know what that parenthesis is adding. But there is a pasuk that we say in Tehillim, we say it twice. Orech yamim asbi'ehu, what's the next word? The arehu bishua si.
Right. It seems to me that Rashi very often tries to give like the most favorable, in Genesis in general, is not as favorable to the patriarchs as later are to different people, but it seems that Rashi is always trying to like fit it in, like, no, they really were, like, Yaakov didn't lie. No, they really were wealthy. No, they had this, and
there's a good reason.
The simple shot is not necessarily like that.
There's a good reason. Either because you hold Masav Asimon upon him, so the way they did it omens for us, so the better I explain them, the better it is for me. Two, there's a lot of disputations going on then, where the Christians were, we have the records. It doesn't seem that Rashi took part in too many of these, but.
Well, the famous thing with the in Spain where they forced the rabbis to have debates.
Sure, that's later. That's late. Spain was more enlightened than France, but at this time for sure. But the disputations, you see that the Christians were very harsh with Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov. They relate to Esav and Ishmael as people that were taking advantage. You keep on pushing away the older ones who deserve God's grace.
Just in general, for me, like, it seems that Rashi, like, very often, like, for example, it says that Tzipora was black, and, like, he tries to go against a lot of, like, what it seems to be a lot of...
I don't think Tzipora was necessarily black, but that Moshe was married to a different black woman.
Kushila,
I mean, how do you know that's Tzipora?
Oh, okay.
Ibn Ezra says it's Tzipora because there was another nation called Kushan, right outside of Midian, mentioned together parallelly in Tanakh. So maybe she should have been called a Kushanit. But if you want to insist that Isha Kushit was Tzipora, there's a Pshat explanation.
Or that he says that, like...
Or that it was an Ethiopian woman he married before he got to...
Or that he says that the reason why they went, when they went down to Egypt with Abraham and Sarah, like, did you just want to take Sarah because, like, they're all black and, like, they don't never...
Okay, Rashi mentions that. What's your point you want to make with this?
I don't know. Rashi... It seems a bit controversial. I don't know.
Like,
it seems like he's going beyond what he has.
Rashi is just regurgitating a Medrash or Gemara or Targum 99.5% of the time. And when he is original, he tells you. He says, "V'li nira v'ani omer," which is rare. But here, almost everything is from Bereishis Rabba and Bereishis or Gemara or Targum. So here, he's just saying, "Lama tisra'u," he says, why do you make yourselves look so satiated in front of the other nations? You should go down and get food like everybody else. Now, orechanim asbi'ehu, you see it? So lama tisra'u could be, that's, you see it? It's probably from the word kosi rivaya, or aleph and vav. Often enough, they interchange. So it could be lama tisra, could mean why you're making yourselves look satisfied when you're not. Then Rashi turns all this on its head afterwards, and he says, "Umipi acherim shemati shu lashon kechusha, lama tiu kechushim berav, v'dom melo umerave gam hu yore." Wow, I don't know what to do with the second part, but Rashi suggests just a very different approach to what this means. But he's avoiding pshat
And he's going to tell us throughout the rest of this story that the main goal in going to Egypt is not to get food. It is...
to look like you're
getting food. To scout it out.
To find Yosef.
Where does it say that?
It doesn't, but that's what Rashi's about to say. Yeah, the whole trip here is to look for Yosef.
Well, then why was Yaakov so like...
Every Rashi here, and it's not...
Well, how was Yaakov so like... how was he not able to believe that Yosef was alive? That was his whole intention.
It's Nasfak Aspaklaria She'ina Me'ira.
I know that means, but like, it just means like a not clear window. But I don't
yeah, he's not. No, it's something that yes, it's beneath the surface. Of course, they're going for food. They need food. They're bringing back food. But in the end, Rashi wants to prime his readers that the brothers are going when they meet. Rashi creates in their first dialogue, why did you come here? We came to find our brothers. Our brother. And says, and what happens if you come with opposition? Will I kill or be killed? See, I told you. I told you guys are spies. You came here to kill? Right? Where did Rashi get all that? It's embraces Rabbi, I get it. But practically every Rashi here has Yosef at the core of what's happening. So here's what I'm suggesting to you. That Rashi sometimes reads an overall theme. We would all read now chapter 42, Bereishis. You'll see that's where it goes. The brothers bring... Why did they have to bring up Yosef? I told you shouldn't sin with the lad. Goodness gracious, that's 22 years ago. Yes.
Is this just a parental instinct to be in denial about a kid, or was there some deeper reason why Yaakov
was always in denial because he never saw anything, but he didn't have a body. Right? So he never saw any ultimate proof. It's an interesting question I once saw in a Sefer, is if Yosef had been married at the time, would his wife be able to remarry?
Mm. Well, they saw the Tonus Pasa himself.
Maybe he lent it to someone.
I mean, without
no DNA. I don't know. Would a wife be able to be married? The Gemara has an interesting discussion.
They never said
we saw a lion pounce on Yosef. No, Adarava. Their innocence was, we just found this daddy. I don't know what it means. Does it look familiar to you? Does this Hakerna? Is this the coat you made for him? Because oh my goodness, that it doesn't look good. It's drenched in blood. Right?
Don't we have this nowadays of war? Like when people go off, they sign a suba al tanai.
Yes, that's good. I have no. Yosef obviously didn't do something like that. But yes, they do. You maybe know the sugi with David and Bacheva and the suba stuff says the Shabbos stuff involved. But the bottom line is the halacha is yes, a wife of Yosef would have been able to remarry. Precisely because the coat was so associated with him. He would never lend it to someone else, not that coat. Any other garment, the Gemara calls it a segula. If it's a segula garment of yours, then yes.
Wasn't all false pretense that really there's a something if he died or not, but nothing to do with the blood and the goat, it was because they left him in the pit, technically, or sold him, or whatnot.
Yeah, they came back to the pit, saw him not there, and then they had to come up with a plan. What are we going to tell Daddy?
Wait, so they saw that he wasn't there, did they assume, I guess that he, no, they sold him. Okay.
Because they purposely stripped him of the garment, because they maybe planned, as soon as they saw him, we're going to use this garment as, you know, something with our plan about how to tell. If we want to kill him, we have to know what to tell Daddy. Right? Now, I submit to you that part of how we need to learn Bereishis, which is resolution, right? Resolution is so crucial. We have to resolve brotherly sibling rivalry. We have to resolve what the brothers did to Yosef. We also have to resolve what Yosef did to the brothers. They accused him of being a spy. He accuses them of being a spy. It's still tit for tat, and that's not a good place. Right? Right, so everyone needs a little bit of kapara. But remember, there's some kapara he must do for even the suggestion of his dreams of ruling over them and the fears that caused in them. And he does that at the end. There is no indication that Yosef ever told his father what happened that day, except one thing. In other words, if I asked you, did Yaakov ever find out what happened to Yosef the day he sent him to look for his brothers? What might be an indication?
Yes, because you just said...
What?
In the blessing, you mentioned archers.
Okay, but that could be the slings and barbs that the brothers had for you.
Yes,
because Kod Nazirachov that we did last class.
He just says that, or one of the brothers tells Yosef, our father told us not to harm us for what we did to you.
Like someone respond to that? Yuvam Estav Samach Gimel?
As the Gemara says that he made that up, I understand that.
Of course, it's a lie!
But,
it is a lie! No one can stand to say that that's true. If Yaakov believed, if Yaakov ever knew that Yosef was sold, and he thought that Yosef would be so vindictive as to kill them all after he's no longer alive, right? In other words, Yosef would be behaving like Esav, waiting for the father to die to kill the bad guys, right? A sentiment that Yosef's brothers obviously did not feel. He might have cried out from the pit, please don't do this. I promise I'll behave. I'll never tell you a dream. I'll never say a bad report. And I'm going to ditch my coat. I'll sell it. Just what are you going to tell Daddy? What are you going to say to him? Right? So, and Yaakov was always asking him. Yosef was in the position to elaborate. Yaakov would have believed anything he'd say. Those brothers, they spit on me and they said, we can't wait to see our father grovel when we tell him you're dead. We're going to show him this coat with blood. Yosef was in a position to lie, to elaborate, to say anything, and Yaakov would have believed him. And then maybe Yaakov would have knocked them all out. Look what he did to Reuven, Shimon, and Levi because of what they did earlier. Think of what he would have done to all the brothers except Binyamin. He could have started a whole nation, just him and Binyamin, right? Who knows what Yaakov would have done to all 10 of them had Yosef told what happened that day. I don't think Yosef ever told him. And, Mr. Farhi, had Yosef really told him, would it make more sense for Yaakov to tell Yosef directly than to tell the brothers to tell Yosef? By the way, when the brothers told this to Yosef, it doesn't appear that they're face to face, because it says by Yishlach.
What I was suggesting was that it was said beforehand what occurred, and then he was making up the fact that his father said not to hurt them. Meaning it was a known thing that Jacob knew what occurred to Joseph, but it was a later addition that he could have made up that, daddy said not to hurt us.
Okay, I'm just saying that Yosef doesn't respond.
If not, that seems like an incredulous thing. Like, you just spilled the beans. Like meaning it. You just now saying like, I just spilled the beans about what just happened.
Yeah, he said, of course you're lying. I never told Daddy that. You told him. Right? Yosef knows they're lying, but the Bible doesn't open that up to us. Right? Gemara just assumes that that's a lie. If Yaakov had known one assumption, and would be so open to thinking Yosef would be so vindictive as to kill them for that, another assumption, surely Yaakov should have gone to Yosef directly in one of those 17 years and told Yosef directly, don't kill your brothers. Tell the brothers to tell Yosef not to kill them? That's strange. So that's part of Yosef's tshuva. You get it? I also have to do some tshuva here. You know, for making my brothers think that I wanted to be Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Yosef. And I'll let them all fall away the same way that Esav did, and the same way the Ishmael did, the same way that all of the Avram's children, the Keturah, did. No, we want to all be part of this great experiment of a nation. Okay, I only read a few Rashis in the beginning of the Perek, but really it goes on and on. They're not going to Egypt for food. They don't need food. Right? Look at the next Rashi. Okay, not Redu. Redu is how Remez for 210 years in Egypt. But Gimel. Vayerdu achei Yosef. Velo kastav b'nei Yaakov. Melameid shahayu mischartim b'mechiraso. V'nasnuli bam lihisnahegimo ba'achva. Well, he says it outright. What do I have to make up anything? He says it outright. We're coming here to find Yosef. And we're going to spend any amount of money for him. Okay, it means they never gave up hope of finding him. Excuse me, it's been 22 years. Well, did they ever do anything until then? They had to wait for a famine? Yes.
So they say every time they left their home, were they on this search for Yosef in case he was there?
Assuming so, yeah. Maybe they never went to Egypt all this time, but did they know he was sold to Egypt? I doubt it. He was sold to Midianites. I'm going to spend 5 minutes with you doing something similar in the beginning of Shmos. Listen to this. Okay? Moshe goes out the first day from the palace, from the his cloistered walls of his upbringing, and the first thing he sees is a Hebrew being beaten mercilessly. Right? Doesn't ask any questions. It just says, Vayifen ko v'cho. Vayar ki eish. You all know what he did. Smote him. We're not sure if he meant to kill him or just he was so incensed that he hit him so hard. But we know he killed him because he buried him in the sand. Doesn't want to be found out. Okay? The next day, he sees two Hebrews fighting. Again, he gets involved in an altercation. This time it's not an Egyptian against the Hebrews, it's two Hebrews. And it says that he stopped them from fighting, but they didn't react well. You're a hypocrite. We heard about you. Yesterday you killed, and now you're telling what called me a Russia for hitting? Halogeni unto America Sherat to Samitri? Next, it says, Vayiro Moshe Vayomar, Ochein Noda Hadavar. Now the thing is known. Can I get four answers here? What's Moshe looking for when he's looking this way and that way? Simple shot, the first thing that comes to your head.
Someone who will see him about to kill someone.
Ayarki Enish, he didn't. Obviously, there were men watching because the next day the guy knew he could. What he was looking for specifically Egyptian.
I've heard before that Enish. Sometimes Adam means Jews and Ish means non-Jews.
Okay.
It can be like
simple shot here. Okay. There's a Rashi in the beginning of Vayikra that discusses this, and there's Tosfos that says because sometimes Adam includes Goyim, sometimes Adam excludes Goyim. It depends on the context. Adam kiya kriv mikem korban, Rashi says, a Goy can bring a korban. It says Adam. Adam kiya muspa ohel, Rashi says, a Gentile does not have tumas ohel, because Adam excludes Goyim. It's complicated. But let's move on. Vayiro Moshe Vayomar, what is Moshe afraid of?
Getting caught.
Now Egyptians know. The cat's out of the bag. I killed. And now I have to, Ochein Noda Hadavar, what's the thing that's known?
That's not.
I killed. Okay. Now, at the
very end of the story, when Moshe is convinced by God after a lot of give and take at the burning bush, about going back to redeem his people, Hashem tells Moshe, Lech shuv Mitzrayim, ki mesu kol ha'anashim ha'mevakshim es nafshecha. Who are those people? I don't have to guess this one, because it says that Paro tried to kill Moshe when he heard that he killed the Egyptian. And it says in between that that Paro died. The people cried out. Maybe the family of the Egyptian he killed, still looking for him and bearing a grudge. Those people are dead too. So Moshe, go back to Israel. Well, go back to Egypt and redeem your people. Okay, did everybody agree with that? Okay, one by one, backwards. Who does Rashi say are dead that now it's safe to go back to Egypt? You remember? These two people fighting. Remember who they are?
Dasan Vavir.
Dasan Vavir. Rashi, what do you tell? This really, you say, I don't mind this. I don't mind finding this in Shmos Rabbah or Sota Daf Yud Aleph. But I do mind finding it in a Perush that constantly says, Ani lo basi ela lo pshuto shel mikra.
But doesn't Rashi say the other people are destined to be one?
Yes, Rashi gets himself into real shot trouble in a few places where he says, this is Dasan Vavir, this is Dasan Vavir, this is Dasan Vavir. Plus, this is Gemara in the Darim, plus, Dasan Vavir are alive in Bamidbar. So what do you mean, Kimesu Kolana Shim is Dasan Vavir? Rashi is, when Rashi says something like this, you know he is desperate to get some kind of message across here. They're not dead. They're alive much later. You see, right? But what's he looking for? He's looking back all around to see, I'm about to kill that man. I know, I'm purposely going to kill him. But I don't want to kill him if there is an Ish in his future. Meaning that I want to look, Moshe's already a Navi according to this. He looks deep into the future and says, he's not, you know, what about this? He's having a son, a grandson, or a great-grandson who's going to convert to Judaism or be a great man or do something important in the world. No, Bayaki ain't Ish. There's no one important in this man's genealogy in the future that I'd be wiping out. I'm going to kill him. All his children are already born. He's not going to have any more children. So I can kill him. That's what Rashi does. What's Moshe afraid of here? Not like Rashi's, like you said before, that I'm afraid that people know that I killed. Rashi says he's afraid, look at the way the Jews behave. I'm trying to help them. I just saved one of them. Moshe only knows he's Jewish for about a half hour, right? So I'm trying to save them, and look how they behave. Look how they talk back to me. Now, what's the thing known to me? What's known? Now I know why the Jews suffer more than any other people. Look at the dilatorah, look at the chutzpah they have. Look how they talk back to me. Okay? What I just did with these five Rashis, I can do with another 15 Rashis in the beginning of Shmos, which is, Moshe is not afraid of Egyptians. What is his main fear and his main apprehension that makes him push back at God throughout the next two chapters at the burning bush is that the people won't accept him. He's tongue-tied. He's tongue-tied for his people. He is not worried about making a stand against an Egyptian. I don't have to worry about seeing if an Egyptian is watching. My main concern that Rashi is saying now, each individual Rashi here and the other 15 are holy drash. Disappointing drash. He's saying, Rashi, come on. I can come up with a better shot than that. Hello, what is Rashi trying to do?
Give background message.
A background theme. That Moshe is not concerned with what he's doing against the Egyptians. His main concern is how is he going to be accepted by his own people. So too here at Gracious Mepes. Of course they're going down for food. There's no doubt that that's the pshat of the story. But Rashi likes to create some theme, a background theme, where he explains individual psukim, individual words even, and it meaning to give you a background, which is, these boys come what may. Maybe not on this trip, but on some trip, I'm going to bring home Yosef. Or we're going to bring home the news that Yosef is alive.
Of course, Rashi has the heart and foresight of knowing that that is what happens. Parshas, right? But Rashi builds it into the whole story as part of what I say is the ikar of what Bereishis needs to do for this chapter on, is resolution of how brothers are behaving with one another. Are they going to do the Binyamin like they did to Yosef? And by Binyamin, it's who told you to steal the cup? I can't believe you! Right? What's the cup doing in your sack? I have to go home and tell them, this time we really wanted to, you know, the last time, okay, maybe we should have been better at bringing Yosef home without telling him what actually happened. But this time, it was Binyamin's fault. Who told him to steal the cup? Right? And yet they don't do that. They stand up for him. Right? Yehuda saves the day, and that's what gives him the malchus. The question I want to deal with next class on Tuesday is, think this over. Why does Yaakov give malchus to Yehuda? Surely it should be given to
Yosef.
He's the one acting like king. Why does malchus go to Yehuda? Don't give it away. This is for Tuesday. Okay. All right, guys. Have a great Shabbos.